Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. I take liberty with my coffee. Bobby Rodrigo here with you. Tuesday night, December 16th, 8:30. We're going to get right into it. I hope everybody's having a nice Christmas season, of course. We've got a lot going on out there in the United States world and Liberty world, and I want to bring you up to speed on a couple of things before we get into tonight's show. First of all, one of the big topics, of course, recently is the passing of this omnibus bill. Briefly, I just want to say to everybody, in my opinion, what's going on with the elected officials at mainstream media is they've been using different sides of this omnibus bill to further divide us. What is interesting is if you look at the voting records of your elected officials and all the elected officials, you will find that in the House, for example, which we know is controlled by the Republican omnibus bill, and there were some Republicans that didn't like it and bolted from their support, and they were very vocal about it for the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and the passage of this bill. And then there was a number of Democrats who bolted from the Democratic side and supported the bill. And then, of course, there were twice as many Democrats that did not vote for the bill. Now, I mention this because you will notice that in the conversations that go on with this bill, you will see that the Republicans that bolted from the bill and don't support John Boehner will not mention the fact that they were supported in their opposition by such a great number of Democrats. Now, when you turn that around and you go to the Senate, you had the exact opposite happening. Now, the Senate, of course, is still controlled by the Democratic Party, and the bill passed. Democrats bolted from the support of the bill, as well as some Republicans, and then they turned that dialogue into another divisive kind of discussion. Instead of standing there, now, for example, we know that one of the big things that have happened from the standpoint of being covered is Elizabeth Warren came out really strong. Justin Amash came out really strong. Ted Cruz, God help us, came out really strong. What was interesting to me is that you had an opportunity here for a coalition of people to stand together on stage in front of the media and say, this is why we disagree with the bill, all of us. Now, all of the reasons might not have been the same. It actually supported programs that violate our rights. It continued to arm rebels in Syria. I mean, when is this going to end? So, excuse my dog barking in the background. So, anyway, I thought it was interesting that they used this to divide us instead of standing together and talking about the various things that were going on. Again, this is just another opinion of mine. I think this is a clear opportunity for, 250 people, essentially. Congress is 535 people. Half of Congress did not like this bill, regardless of party. Why didn't they get up there and stand together and talk about it instead of cherry-picking different reasons? And talking bad of all the Democrats did this and they're supporting this and John Boehner betrayed the voting constituents. There's a lot going on in that bill that was bad for this society, really bad for our country. So I expect our elected officials to do way better, and I expect them to work together regardless of party, principle over party, people. If something is wrong, it's wrong. It doesn't matter. We all know that giving more money and giving more opportunity for Wall Street to put the shaft to us is a bad thing. We also know that subsidies and stuff are not exactly constitutional, which, of course, is my big platform, as you know. So I just wanted to point that out. Another thing that I found interesting recently, there was an article in the Huffington Post, I believe it came out yesterday, and it was talking about the unsafe transportation of oil on the rail cars and the rail cars that are unsafe themselves. A lot of it was two things. The rail cars have not been updated to be safe. And the fact that they're transporting so much more oil, of course, is involved. This is, again, we're talking about something that is exactly the same as the Keystone Pipeline. So it got me thinking, and I went to look behind it a little bit. Because, of course, the Coffee Party, one of the big platforms that we have at the Coffee Party is money and politics, and it's always about the money. We follow the money, you find everything, pretty much. So there is a discussion that comes from the right that talks about the Keystone Pipeline. Now, the majority of people that I know, including myself, let me make this clear, I'm anti-Keystone Pipeline. There's no way that that is good for our country. There's no way that it creates jobs. I don't want to hear about the tar sands. I don't want to hear about how the government should intervene with the free market. That's not what this is about at all. You're not going to get me to go down that road with you. It's not going to happen. But the hypocrisy that I see, at least that is undercurrent this, is that you? When you talk about money in politics, there is money on both sides. You know, the left talks about the Koch brothers, bad people, et cetera. And yet you have, and I've talked about this at length, and that you have people like George Soros and Warren Buffett doing things the same way as Koch brothers are. Of course, the right people from the right might particularly like what the Koch brothers are supporting, so they turn a blind eye. People from the left do the same thing with Soros and Buffett, per se. The idea is money should be out of politics, period. It should be our vote that rules the day. Policy should be based upon what's good for our society. That's me and my soapbox. So I went and looked deeply into this rail car thing, and of course the majority of the money that's made from the transportation of oil by train is Warren Buffett's money. It hits his pocket directly. So, of course, there could be an argument made that from the standpoint of voting against the Keystone Pipeline, Warren Buffett is going to lobby that direction because it's going to affect his wallet if he's not able to transport oil. Money in politics, of course, I'm skeptical, so I'm going to believe that argument more often than I'm not. But putting that aside, I found an article that was put out in January of this year. Oil on the tracks. More oil cars in 2013 than in the previous four decades. So I had to read that. As a direct result of the Bakken shale oil boom, more crude oil was spilled from rail cars last year than in the previous four decades combined. That according to the McClassey analysis of federal data for the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, which govern rails transport. I'm going to put this link into our chat room so people can take a look at it and follow along with me. I see that we have some people in the chat room. So the hazardous, the analysis revealed more than 1.15 million gallons of crude oil spilled in 2013, considerably more than the 800,000 gallons spilled from 1975 when the government started collecting data on spills from 2012. That's huge. So when you talk about the safety aspect, the argument of the safety aspect of the Keystone Pipeline, you have the same thing going on with the rail cars. So obviously the first thing you want to say, if you're somebody who would prefer that we have a safe society, is they stop doing both. That, of course, would be preferable, obviously. It's not going to happen. So they have to fix something. But I just wanted to raise the thing that when there's always something going on, if they're not going to do the Keystone Pipeline and line the pockets of this particular party, somebody else is doing the same thing in another way and they're lining those pockets. And neither one of them appears to be safe for our society. So perhaps maybe the answer is somewhere else. Another one of the recent headlines that we have is just yesterday, an Arizona judge, switch directions here, go directly to Liberty. Police don't have to disclose public records on Stingray spy tech. For those who don't know what the Stingray is a device that's being used by the police that mimics a cell phone tower to collect metadata on mobile devices, including geolocation, so law enforcement can map connections and follow suspects. Of course, the civil rights side of the argument says the device violates the U.S. Constitution. Absolutely, it does. You have to have a warrant. We keep bringing in policy and devices that directly violate the probable cause standards that are in the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. We just keep eroding it, essentially. We're disregarding the fact that we have these constitutional protections in place to protect humans from government overreach, we are supposed to not lose life, liberty, or property, or pursuit of happiness without due process of law. If a human, not an American citizen, a human being, is accused of violating a United States law, they are afforded these constitutional protections. That's what our Constitution is about. So, a judge took it upon himself to say that the records don't have to be released to this, to this, on the Stingray spy tech. The scenario is that the judge says, well, that information being released would help the criminals too much. And I'm just like, okay, so we're just going to continue to go along the secret path, which also is a violation of a constitutional rights, because our government is supposed to be transparent. It's supposed to be public. We know that. Another headline, important, especially for the Liberty Movement, and especially for the freedom of the press, is there the sentencing hearing is going on right now for Barrett Brown, advocate for Anonymous. Barrett Brown is another person who was handed a bunch of information, similar to like Glenn Greenwald was from Edward Snowden, that was exposing what was going on inside our government, the unconstitutional behavior within our government that we now know actually happened because, of course, our government now has come out and admitted it after it was exposed by Barrett Brown, after it was exposed by Edward Snowden, after it was exposed by Chelsea Manning. We know these things happen. And Barrett Brown is facing, could face, almost 10 years in prison on criminal hacking charges. But his allies say he's just a journalist and the government is punishing him to stifle free speech. I happen to agree with that argument after studying this case for so long. It's been going on for a few years. Another post that I will put into the chat room for review. Anybody can take a look at it. So that's an update on the current affairs. Just a brief overview of some of the things that are going on. I think it's important to stay on top of it as much as possible. It is ridiculously hard to do so, that's for sure. And then, of course, we know about some of the more divisive and major stories that have been going on. And before I get into tonight's show, I see that we have a couple of callers. One of them is our guest coming up. I see you there, Tom. I'll get to you in a second. I have a caller right now. I want to see if you have any questions for us. It's area code 781. What is your name, where you're calling from, and what is your question?
One of them is our guest coming up. I see you there, Tom. I'll get you in a second. I have a caller right now. I want to see if you have any questions for us. It's area code 781. What is your name, where you're calling from, and what is your question?
Hello, area code 781. Might be having some difficulties. Okay. Getting back to the show. Now, some of the things that are going on, and I'll get back to you, area code 781. I'll try again. I've been having problems with the board since I logged in. I have my other phone on just in case my headset goes out so I can dive right in and not lose the momentum of the show. Anyway, we've had major incidents happen in our society that has been in the forefront of the media, and then we have the same kind of incidents happening that are not in the forefront of the media. Of course, I'm talking about the Brown case in Ferguson, talking about the Eric Garner case in Staten Island, Tamir Rice. The one that really gets me, and I apologize for not remembering the gentleman's name, but the gentleman that was shot coming down the stairs in the building where the police were going up, they weren't chasing him, he wasn't a suspect, they weren't interacting with him, he was walking down the stairs and they shot him. Again, another situation where the coroner ruled it a homicide. And we know that the grand jury in Ferguson decided not to indict. We know that the grand jury in Staten Island decided not to indict. We've seen. And then we have this case that the Coffee Party has been covering, that I have personally been covering, here in Georgia, where I am located, where Lawrence County, Georgia, Dublin, Georgia, I would say about 40 minutes outside east, northeast of Macon, Georgia, where a gentleman by the name of David Hooks had been burglarized, and he reported the burglary to the police. And, of course, I'm not going to over-speculate on this. We know some things for sure. We speculate on other things for sure. I'm going to try and keep as much speculation out of this. It's one of the reasons why I asked to have the guest on that I do tonight. We have a situation where he was burglarized. The police and the perpetrator of the burglary interacted together, either by arrest, turning himself in, drive stop, whatever that particular thing is. And I'll let Tom McCain discuss that part of it. What resulted from that interaction turned out to be a warrant, to a knock warrant, not a no-knock warrant, a knock warrant for David Hooks, where the police were supposed to go knock on his door and say, we're going to search your house for drugs. Instead of executing the warrant that way, they decided to do a raid at 11 o'clock at night, and the results of this raid was David being gunned down in his home. And there is evidence that clearly shows that David was shot while he was prone face down on the ground as well. Now, one of the issues that I have with this, the Coffee Party has discussed with this, and the people who are trying to bring this out, is why isn't the media covering this like they're covering the others? Now, one of the factors that's missing, of course, is the divisive issue of race allegations. Because David Hooks is a white man who lived in the community for a long time, and it wasn't black police, white police, whatever police was there. It was just police that was there, and David was a white person. So they could not bring that to the forefront. Another black man got killed. And it's important to understand that the discussion here is about citizens being killed by the police and not being afforded due process. Now, before I go on, I want to make it clear, because this has been something that is troubling. I am not anti-police at all. I want to make that clear. I am not anti-police at all. I am anti-police brutality. I'm anti any brutality. I believe in the sanctity of all human life, and I believe in the Constitution, and it says clearly to me that no person shall be deprived without due process, period. So when I see instances of this happen, especially when life is lost, forget about the other aspects of liberty, just when we talk about the sanctity of life, I have to step up and talk about it regardless of the makeup of the perpetrator. Whether black, white, green, yellow, purple, alien, whatever, and whether or not the person is actually turns out to be guilty or not of the incident has nothing to do with how the interaction between the police and the perpetrator happened. So I want to discuss that at length with you, my audience. I want to introduce to you my guest. His name is Tom McCain. Tom is a 20-year retired Air Force Master Sergeant, retired in 1991. He settled in Lawrence County at that time, and after retiring from the military, he went to work for the Lawrence County Sheriff's Office. Among his qualifications is that he is a POST, and that is a acronym, POST, Certified Peace Officer. He's a Certified General Law Enforcement Classroom Instructor. He's a Certified Firearms Instructor. I wish everybody was, as far as anybody handling a firearm. Yeah, he holds an advanced senior deputy certification, which is a course of study dealing with strictly the constitutional office of sheriff in Georgia. And in the community, in the law enforcement community, he's considered a scholar of that office. Now, he worked as a deputy sheriff in this county, in Lawrence County, where David Hooks was killed from 1992 to 1998. At that time, he took a break because his protege was murdered. And he took a break from law enforcement to get over that. And then he became the chief deputy for Johnson County, Georgia, from 2001 to 2008, serving under Sheriff Rusty Oxford. And then he ran unsuccessfully for the sheriff's office for Lawrence County. He's now retired. And while living in Nebraska, where he was with his children, he heard about this incident, and we'll talk about that as to what he's doing back here and how he wind up on your doorstep on Coffee Party Radio. So without further waiting, I'm going to bring in Tom McCain and introduce him to the Coffee Party Radio crowd. How are you, Tom?
Doing well. Thank you, sir. Thanks for asking.
Welcome to I take liberty with my coffee and Coffee Party Radio. I'm glad to have you here. I appreciate you taking the time to educate us on what goes on behind the badge. I think it's very important to bring the law enforcement people out into the front to discuss this the right way. So I appreciate you being here tonight.
Yeah, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
So I was talking about how you wound up involved. I wanted you to let our audience know how you travel, or why, what were the circumstances in you traveling back from Nebraska when you heard about the David Hooks case.
Well, a old partner of mine had called me up and asked me to come back down here and help him get a business set up, and we were making plans to do that. He called me a couple of days after the initial call, and he says, "You ain't going to believe this," and he told me what had happened. So I said goodbye to my two daughters and my five grandkids up there, and I packed everything up, and I came back. I can't let this stand. I want to piggyback, if I could, on something you said. I'm not anti-cop either. I'm not anti-law enforcement.
Certainly not.
Anybody think that I am, hell, I am a cop, okay? Actually, I was in Alabama State Police Academy in, back in the 60s. Early 70s. But, so I've been doing it for a long time. And I'm not anti-cop. I'm just anti-bad cop. And I spent 20 years of my life bouncing around the world carrying arms or sending the pilots out, whichever came first, for my country. And
thank you for your service.
Thank you, sir. And I cannot see the Constitution that I fought for and I spent time away from family for trampled on like this.
So essentially, when you got this phone call and they gave you the incidents, you got a sense right away that there was an injustice, that you, considering how close you were and that you worked in the community, if I understand you correctly, you immediately had to do something about it. Is that how you see it?
That's it. That's exactly how.
I applaud you for that.
And look, here's I have children. Barb and I, my wife Barb, and I have a melded family. Two sons that belong to her, but that are mine, just to, and call me daddy just as surely as, you know.
Certainly.
The day is long. And then I have two daughters up in Nebraska, as I mentioned before. But the point is, those two sons live in Lawrence County. I've got 17 grandchildren in Lawrence County because Barb and I have always been folks that would take waifs in. You know, we were foster parents. When we were up there in Nebraska, we fostered over 100 children. A lot of my son's family is also male. But I've got this extended network there, 17 grandchildren, two great-grandchildren, and two more on the way. And if this had happened...
Kind of gives you a connection to the local community, doesn't it?
Tell me, it gives me a... You know, home's where the heart is. And
sure is.
Mine's kind of split because I got family here, I got family in Nebraska, and I try to do my best to spend as much time with each one of them as I can. But
certainly, of course, it gives you a connection of wanting to see justice all the time in the community as well.
That's right.
Well, fantastic. I got to meet you Saturday, of course. There was for those of you that don't know, the coffee party covered a rally in Lawrence County in which Tom McCain was one of the speakers discussing this case, and what is hoped to be achieved, and bringing it to the information to the community and hopefully nationwide to the media that was broadcasting the particular rally. And Coffee Party was there doing that, myself along with one of the other radio shows, Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis. And it was a pleasure to meet you and listen. Actually, we listened to you speak. It was a wonderful speak that you did. And then, of course, we had a chance to sit down later on, which made me think to reach out to you to have you on the show. And I got the sense of the emotion when Mr. Hooks' father spoke. It was amazing, of course. But I got the sense of where you were coming from, because you know these people.
Look here, let me interrupt this. Let me interrupt you a second, Bobby. I want to mention Mr. Paul Hooks. 92 years old, I believe he is. World War II veteran, fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He's a hero, and a fine, upstanding member of that community, and as are the rest of his family. So I'd just like to mention that.
Absolutely, and if anybody wants to look at, you can find the video of the rally on Operation Educate on Facebook. There's a couple of other places on the internet. I'll have to look for it and post it in the chat room. And I know that we have it inside the newsroom that we do at the coffee party. But anyway, back to the subject. What I wanted to cover with you, Tom, first of all, just going through this event and the policy and practice of the police, is, of course, we have a situation where, and I don't want to go overly speculate, as I mentioned before I brought you on, I want to try and stay to facts as much as possible and reasonable assumptions, of course, but I don't want to do too much speculation. I know that they haven't released a lot, and they're getting pressure for that. But starting with the report of the burglary and the police interaction with informants, with your law enforcement history, of course, you have interacted with informants, I'm going to assume. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So could you just give us an idea of how you would do that in a circumstance, taking the fact that however the connection happened when the perpetrator for the burglary revealed to the police, if you're standing there and he's telling you, well, the drugs that are in this truck are from the burglary that I just committed at this house, and your normal interaction with the informant, what would you do? How would you approach that?
Well, the first thing I'd have to do is stop laughing. You take everything with a grain of salt when you arrest somebody. I think I've done a good bit of research on this. I'm still a pretty damn good investigator. And,
sure.
And I've got sources around here. You know, there's people that know me. Sure. I was a member of this community for 21 years. I have people talking to me. I think the sheriff's office is too stupid to realize that, because they think they've got everything sewed up tight out there. But that ain't the case. As a matter of fact, I'd like to mention this. You know, you said something about policy. Well, the sheriff keeps saying that, and I hate to call him that, because he ain't no damn sheriff. But, not in my book, anyway.
Sure.
But
the power statement right
there. Well, he keeps saying that it's the policy of his office not to make comments on open investigations. But yet he's got his drug czar, Chris Brewer, is out telling his side of the story at ball games to any damn body to listen. He's calling people idiots on his Facebook page for calling him out about it. I just kind of like to ask the question, hey, Bill, what is your policy? You know, and if that's your policy, then why can't your appointed deputies uphold that policy? And I think I've got the answer for that. But go ahead, Bobby. This is your show.
No, certainly. Again, it is important to me, I believe, that a community understand how this happens. You know, the Eric Garner case is one situation. You have a person who's alleged to break a victimless law, ridiculous law. But, you know, and again, my position there is that it's 0 to 90 where the chokehold, we know, is an illegal chokehold as far as policy is concerned. The person uses it, it's considered a homicide. They don't indict the way that they do that. This case, to me, is way more egregious because there was all this process that went on. And I know you could talk about, for example, let's just say this informant tells you this story, and you know this guy, whatever the circumstances may be that lets you at least look into what he's saying. Well, when you're going to go interact with this guy, when you're going to go get the warrant that why they wound up getting, and you're going to interact with this guy, tell the audience what you do, what process do you go through to get the information about the guy that you're going to get the warrant on and before you go near this gentleman's house.
Well, what should have happened is there should have been some due diligence in this case. But before just taking the word of a meth head who had four felony charges hanging over his head, and who, by the way, was also already working for them as a confidential informant.
Another important aspect of this case, yes.
Right. And due diligence lacking here, you know. They should have gone out and done some independent verification. There's ways to do that, and that should have been done, and it just wasn't.
What I mean about my question to be a little bit more accurate here is, for example, regardless of how you know about the information, if you're going to walk up to somebody's house to either execute a warrant or talk to him with probable cause, that it, you know, and you have some kind of suspicion or whatever it is that there's something going on in a house criminal, you're going to know everything about that person inside the house, and you're going to have his picture in front of you on a piece of paper, and you're going to have his record, that you know, whatever might exist, an NCIC sheet or however you pull the information out there. You're not going in there blind. Am I right about that?
That's correct. It's called gathering intel.
Certainly. So when these people start interacting with David Hooks, first of all, he called in a crime, and we can't forget that. And we know that there was an interaction between some people in the department and David Hooks at his house that day in the afternoon, from what I understand.
Right.
So
we don't know what that was exactly, but we do understand that, yes.
Right. And I know that information is coming out. So now you have them deciding, number one, that the warrant is a knock warrant, number one, and they decide to do this nighttime raid that results in the death of David Hooks. And I'm sure one of the things that is getting you is I can't put together the dots that go from interacting with the gentleman in the afternoon, having a knock warrant, a type of search warrant to execute, and winding up there in the middle of the night doing what they did. I can't connect those dots. I would assume you have the same problem.
Well, I do, but I think if we take a look at the timeline, there's probably a couple of deputies out there talking to him about the burglary or something related to the burglary, and then they wind up getting hold of Garrett, the CI, after those talks. The more I look at that, the more I think that's probably what it is. But one never knows. There again, that's just speculation on my part, but it would make sense.
Certainly. I see that we have a caller, Tom, so I want to take a break right there and bring in our caller. I think I know who it is as well. I believe it's Catherine Bernard. So I want to bring her on, if I'm right about that, and have her participate in the conversation. Area code 404, this is I Take Liberty With My Coffee. Is that you, Catherine?
I am indeed on the phone. I couldn't get it to work on the internet, actually, but if y'all want me on here, I'm happy to join in. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Not a problem. I you know what? I guess I don't know if you pressed one to speak. I saw your number and I recognized it. So hey, why not have come in, and maybe you have a question or have a comment.
Oh, I was just posting on Facebook to make sure everybody knew that, you know, Spartacus Legal's chief investigator Tom McCain was commenting on law enforcement policy and practice. I think that's such an important perspective to make people comfortable learning the facts about the David Hooks case, that they don't have to be anti-law enforcement. They just have to be pro-good law enforcement.
That's right.
Absolutely. And that, again, I don't know if you heard my comments earlier, and that's really important, and I'll say it again to everybody. My personal feeling is exactly the way Catherine just said it, and Tom emphasized it earlier. I am not anti-law enforcement, no way, shape, or form. I am anti-police brutality. I am anti-unconstitutional behavior by anybody in government, police or otherwise. And I believe what we're seeing is a percentage of the state, quote-unquote, behaving unconstitutionally in their interactions with people who are alleged to have done something wrong. And I think it's important that we get back to how everybody's supposed to be behaving as far as respecting the due process rights of individuals. And that's all that should be going on here, and it seems like we've lost our way there, and we have a lot of people who have acquiesced to this behavior, and then you have this ridiculous argument back and forth that if you have one position, you must have the other, and that's just not true, I would imagine. Please comment on that, everybody.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, I just completely agree, and you know what we're trying to do. You know, I mentioned Spartacus Legal, where you know Tom is actually one of our first people on the case, really showing his experience and getting into the facts of these cases. But we're a nonprofit legal organization that is designed to ferret out these cases of injustice and bring them to a wider audience. Because the things that Tom has seen in his years as a deputy at the Lawrence County Sheriff's Office and at the Johnson County Sheriff's Office, that's a perspective that most people just don't get. And so I think it really is very valuable to bring that to bear on these cases that we read about in the news. You know, I'm a criminal defense attorney, you know, so I think that brings another important perspective. But the things that people are seeing in the criminal justice system are really troubling, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to bring the sides together so that everybody can come together and agree on some needed reforms. I think Tom has a lot of stories about things he's seen that he has not been happy with, and maybe he can even comment on some of the issues involving the man who actually got the search warrant in this case, Deputy Chris Brewer, the head of the Lawrence County Drug Task Force.
Well, yeah, sure.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. I want to get back into it. Absolutely. Thank you, Catherine. One of the things that is important here is here we go. We have this interaction with the police in the afternoon, and then you go back to the informant, which is where we left off, and how this search warrant process happened. Talk a little bit about how that works, Tom, please.
All right. Well, of course, you've got to take your evidence to a magistrate judge, and that magistrate has to make a decision about whether it warrants the approval of the search warrant. The way we always did it, both in Lawrence County and in Johnson County, which, like I said, we did some independent verification. And it's easy for somebody to walk in off the street and say, hey, Joe Schmuckatelli over there is dealing drugs. If you walk into a reasonable magistrate with that, they're going to laugh you out of their office.
Certainly.
So you have to do some independent investigation. Now, what we did with our confidential informants is we turned them into confidential, reliable informants, and we made buys with them. If they gave us information that old Joe down there was doing dope, then we'd say, okay, and we'd go through our procedures, and we'd send him in. And he'd make a buy, and he'd come out. And we'd do that two or three times so that we knew that we were on solid footing. And then we'd take that to the magistrate. And
controlled interaction between an alleged perp and your informant.
Exactly. And
now, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, okay, so essentially, what you're describing here is establishing a probable cause threshold for the magistrate, like you say, corroborating independent or controlled by or any of these aspects that provide a baseline for this warrant. Now, on this particular case with David Hooks, that wasn't done. My information is correct from what I've learned about the case and speaking to the people involved, including both yourself and Catherine. What we had was some kind of an allegation from years past that there may or may not been methamphetamine and David Hooks together that they used as the alleged corroborating situation in a reasonable case. Is that not correct?
That's correct, but that was from 5 years ago when there was never any arrest made or never, nothing was ever done about that. Nothing ever came of that.
Right. So it's interesting. So here we have another situation where the magistrate is doing what? Just letting the detective or the deputy sheriff that you mentioned, Chris Brewer, I believe is the right name, is leading him where? I mean, I have a problem with the magistrate issuing a search warrant on the situation, period. We know, as experienced people in the legal field, that this does not muster the proper threshold. And if David Hooks would have not been killed, and he would have been, there would have been drugs in the house, which we know there wasn't, after a 44-hour search, we have to get to that, we'll get to that. We know that they didn't exist, but if there does, we would have a basis for suppression in a hearing to suppress the evidence on the basis of lack of probable cause, which of course we know is a tough argument to win, but there would be a basis for it because there was no way to corroborate the, and I know this is lawyer stuff. I know this is after your investigative part, but that's what's going on here in my view. What would you say to that, Tom?
Couldn't agree with you more. I had that gone to court, then the evidence that they gathered that night would most probably have been thrown out. Had there been a good defense attorney like Catherine Bernard on the case, there would So
stopping it right there. So looking at the aspect of, okay, now we have a loss of life. Please, Catherine, go right ahead.
Well, I actually, I hate to disagree, but I think that warrant might well have stood up in court, and I think that's one of the most troubling things about this case is that, under the Fourth Amendment, we're supposed to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures, and I think anybody looking at this case can see this was an unreasonable search at 11 o'clock at night on a man who had just been burglarized, but what we're seeing in the courts is that overwhelmingly these search warrants are being affirmed. And that's because of the way the actual law is written, where the magistrate's judgment is given tremendous deference as a matter of law. So even if a superior court judge has some questions about what's going on, they almost always will affirm. I have argued hundreds of thousands of these motions to suppress, hundreds against Chris Brewer himself, actually. And what's unfortunate is that if there's just a couple of magic words they say, they can get that reliability. And the issue that I think would have come up in this particular case is that they were saying that Rodney Garrett's statement was a statement against his own interest, so that gave it indicia of reliability. I think that's the argument that the prosecutor would have made, and I can see it working, honestly. And I think that's not a great set of incentives. I think the whole confidential informant system is not a great set of incentives. You let somebody out of jail for stealing so he can go after somebody who, even if he did have drugs, at least he's not stealing from people. I'd rather keep the thief in jail and, not get him out of jail and pay him to go and trap other people.
Bob always had a
problem. No doubt. And Catherine, you raise a good point, of course. You mentioned that you've argued a number of these cases. We have seen, and you know this more than I do because you work in the field, we have seen an erosion of our protections under the Fourth Amendment since Mapp v. Ohio way back when. I mentioned that because there was the Mapp, the petitioner in Mapp just recently died, actually. So it brought up the case, and of course that goes back to one of the ways that our protections were enumerated by the Supreme Court. But just yesterday, the Supreme Court announced in an 8-1 decision that it's okay for the police to be wrong by why they pull you over And even though they didn't have probable cause to pull you over, legally, by the basis of the law, it's still okay. So you're right. They certainly have leaned on the discretion of the magistrate. They certainly give deference to law enforcement without question. We see that all the time. It is unfortunate. And, of course, the only thing that works here is that, obviously, there were no drugs. I mean, we know that the three of us, for example, and the other people who are familiar with this case and Lawrence County and everybody in the country should realize that this person was not breaking the law at all, and there were no drugs in the house, and the informant's information was completely false, which just adds to the tragedy here without question. I appreciate those comments, Catherine. So, Tom.
Well, and I have to go back to if we can get Tom to tell some of his law enforcement stories that involve this particular officer and any other ones he might want to share. I think, you know, people expect defense attorneys to complain about the drug task force. I think it's very powerful to hear, you know, the perspective of law enforcement and the folks who've actually worked together.
Oh yeah, without question. And I definitely want to get into that. The Tom, one of the things that, of course, is so bad in this particular case is what actually happened when the police showed up. And before we get to that, when we look at the way that they interacted with this informant, and you know this gentleman, Chris Brewer, you worked with this gentleman, Chris Brewer, give us some background on Officer Brewer, please.
Well, Chris and I met in jail. We were both working in jail, worked opposite shifts. So that's where I met him. After about a year, I got moved out of jail, and I became the county's juvenile officer. And they were going to, you know, they had to send me to school for that. And during the course of, and at that point in time, police academy was 7 weeks. Pretty short little course, actually. I found out that they were going to increased that by a couple of weeks. I think it might have been going to 11. It might have gone to 9 first, but it's immaterial. They were going to increase it, and I led the chief deputy, Vernon DeLoach, who recently passed away, by the way. Let him know about that, and they decided to send 3 of us to school at the same time. So Chris Brewer, Jed Jenks, and I went to mandate together. Now, Jed was a corporal in the jail, and he wound up being promoted to sergeant back in the jail, stayed back there, and also acted as transport officer and all that. But Chris was put into the civil division after he came back. So we spent 9 weeks in the same hotel room. Jed and I had one part of the room, and there was a door between the two, and Chris had that one. So I know this guy. I know what his performance was in the police academy, which wasn't all that bad. He just came in second for everything. Jed James took the target or the pistol award, and I took the academic award. Chris came in second in both of those categories. So, and one of the things I noticed about him early on was he's always trying to figure out ways to get around things. And it hurt me, but, you know, I had my job to do, he had his job to do. So, but the fact that we both had kind of a day shift job, as a juvenile officer, my primary duty was serving papers for juvenile court. So the civil division, one of their primary duties is serving papers for the superior court. So we worked, we were able to work day shift most of the time. I was able to actually pick my hours because it's a lot easier to keep, catch people at home in the evening. But at any rate, because of the fact that we had some flexible schedules. We were used as security at football games and things along those lines. First thing I've noticed about Chris, and I can't say this for certainty, I want everybody to understand, I'm not making any accusations, I'm just making an observation that bothered me.
Certainly.
We were at a we were performing security at a football game. Chris and I were walking around together, and I don't know, I kind of always try to keep Chris in front of me. But we were walking along, and there's by the side of the building, we saw a group of young men standing there, and it was a recessed doorway with a trash can. And it wasn't lighted. It was dark in there. So as Chris started approaching them, they turned around and started walking out or walking away. And these were several young black men. And so they started walking away. And Chris walked over to that doorway and went over behind the trash can, and when he came up, he had some baggies of weed in his hand, and he went over there and called the guys, and they stopped. It wasn't like they took off running or doing anything like that, but anyway, they stopped, and Chris rested. Well, I had a problem with it, but it was his case. I mean, I did not see the stuff laying on the ground myself. I can't say whether it was or whether it wasn't, but it just always kind of bothered me. You know, he could have called me over and said, "Hey, look, what's down there?" And
wouldn't that be normal practice to do that in order to confirm it actually, in order to do it the right way?
Well, you would think so.
From a standpoint of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that this was in fact there, all those things that are needed, you would think that would be the way to do it. You know, yeah, I see what you're saying. Let me ask you this: getting back to the David Hook specifics here, one of the things that is so troubling, of course, is the way that the police behaved when they decided to do this raid, or whatever, I don't know what to call it, whenever they decided to interact with the David Hook's home, I guess we'll call it that way, without making an assumption, trying to stay on point. Before we get to the actual shooting information, tell me about that. Tell me about what your experience is there. When you're going, let's throw away the fact that they are executing a warrant a different way than what the warrant is for. Tell me about how a police task force behaves that way, or is supposed to behave that way.
Well, if you've got a no-knock warrant, I mean a knock and announce warrant, then you need to walk up and knock on the door and give them a chance to come to the door.
Certainly.
Had you been able to prove that there was some exigent circumstance that if you've been able to persuade a magistrate that there was some exigent circumstance that would preclude you from giving them some time to answer the door, then the magistrate would have approved a no-no.
Sure.
So, you know, a knock and announce is you walk up and you knock on the door and you announce sheriff's office and you give them a few minutes to come to the door, and then you state your business. The law does say that if they don't answer the door within a reasonable amount of time, that you are authorized to break it. Let's talk about the word reasonable. Here's a Georgia law, 17.526, and it says when search warrant may be executed. And this is out of the criminal procedures, search and seizures, searches with warrants section of Georgia Code. And it says, the search warrant may be executed at any reasonable time. So, you know, let's talk about that. David Hooks was a man of habit. He got up and went to work every morning. I've got a friend that runs a little convenience store on Highway 319, and he said David came in there every morning about the same time, got a cup of coffee and a honey bun, or he got a cup of coffee and a sausage biscuit, one of two.
Sure.
And it was every morning, okay? Now, that meant that he had to drive down his three-quarter mile long driveway, come out between two brick pillars that and a gate that was at the edge of the property, and turn south and headed down 319, and then got about 2 miles down the road and hit the service station. Now, it would have been reasonable to me to have got him at one of those points, either when he was exiting his gate or when he was at his morning stop, and had there been some due diligence, had they followed him around a little bit and done some investigation instead of just making this rush to judgment, then they would have known all of that, and they would have been able to just go ahead and stop him and say, Mr. Hooks, we have a search warrant for your property, and we need you to come with us back up to your house.
Certainly.
That would have been reasonable, and, a reasonable time. The search warrant may be executed, and by the way, I hate that word. I think it needs to be changed in Georgia law. It needs to say serve. Executed is a pretty damn nasty word, especially
sure.
In light of this case, okay?
Sure.
So, anyway, get off of that soapbox. And what's a reasonable time? You know, when he's on his way to work in the morning is a reasonable time. When he's stopping off at his favorite coffee place every morning on his way to work, that's a reasonable time. You know, 11 o'clock at night is not a reasonable time.
Certainly, and there's a lot of hours between that stop for a cup of coffee and a sausage biscuit and 11 o'clock at night. We certainly have, as we all know, we have dinner time. We have any time. It's the as you say, the aspect of reasonableness is ludicrous from their approach to it. There's no question about it. Again, it's going to be interesting to see what they have to say to that when they're made to answer on this particular thing. And another thing is going to be interesting, as I'm sure you believe, and Catherine and everybody else involved in this particular case, is what the search warrant says. You know, when what exactly is going on there? What information was being used and what exactly the wording was of that particular basis for the search warrant, without a doubt. And again, what the police investigation reveals as to why they did what they did, how they did it, in not having a reasonable time, as you described, without question. So moving on from that, you have this, what, raid at 11 o'clock. And let's get into the nuts and bolts of that. We have a situation where we know the story, we've heard the story from Mrs. Hooks herself. She said exactly what she remembers on how this tragedy happened right in front of her, which is another aspect of this that is just so beyond comprehension. You know, I hope nobody ever has to see what she saw and have it happen to her. And, of course, she is the one that sees what's going on out the window, and they just were burglarized. So her panic, is going to be understandable. The whole thing from the standpoint of Hook's side is understandable. Talk about that, please.
Well, there again, this is a rush to judgment. It's just a colossal – we had a term for it.
I know. We don't want to speculate too much, but golly gee, Willikers.
Yeah, but look, here she is. A couple nights, one night after the burglary, and she looks out the window, and there aren't police lights coming up the driveway. There's,
right. You
know, vehicles with their lights off coming up across the damn place,
right.
Behind the pond there, and dispersing from behind those vehicles are men dressed in camouflage with hoods on their heads, which I still got an issue with that. It's actually against the law in Georgia to wear hoods. So, if I can't wear one, then why can they wear one? That never has made a whole lot of sense to me. But, it's kind of like, well, if I can't speed, how come you can't speed? I mean, how come you get to speed? How many times have you been passed by a deputy sheriff with no emergency equipment on, just flying? You guys out there think about that. So if they can do it, how come we can't do it? But anyway, she sees Miss Teresa fighting her. She sees these men coming across the yard, and she panics. But David's already downstairs asleep, and he gets up, or she screams down to him, David, I think the burglars are back, and heads downstairs, and David's coming up out of what we can assume maybe was a sound sleep, and he's groggy.
Sure.
He grabs a shotgun, and he comes out, and about the time that he comes out, they do their, and now I'll explain something too. Okay, a no-knock warrant. We were talking about the difference between a knock and
right.
a bounce and a while ago. You're giving a reasonable amount of time. Well, and there again, reasonable, okay? At 11 o'clock at night, the people in the bed, you should have made that knock and expected to wait for maybe 10 minutes for somebody to answer that door.
Absolutely.
Or sleep at 11 o'clock at night. So there's a little thing that I saw kind of developing as I was leaving leaving Lawrence County, so, and that was kind of a hybrid version of the knock and announce. And what they do is they run up, they knock on the door twice, yell sheriff's office, and then breach the door. Now, that's not reasonable to me. So by the time David comes out from behind the, comes out of the bedroom, which he was doing legally, because there's another law in Georgia that says that you may use whatever force is necessary.
That's right.
To prevent an illegal entry into your home. Well,
that is absolutely.
I didn't know it wasn't. They're going to claim.
Didn't know.
Well,
we know he didn't
illegal.
Know.
But he didn't know. Absolutely did not.
Right.
And so he thinks that he is legally about to defend his house. The door gets breached. Somebody yells gun, and it all went south from there.
Yeah.
And it was a colossal cluster.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And then, of course, the discussion by his attorney, which was pretty scary, when they talked about how he had bullet entry wounds that appeared from analysis to show he was face down, lying in his own blood when he was shot these two times. Now, we're going to get a lot more information on that whenever the coroner's report is released as well, and whenever there's an opportunity to do an independent one if necessary. But this is the discussion that his attorney, responsible human being, representing the family, as you know, and I'm sure Catherine agrees, that shows this particular aspect of the case, which, again, what the hell are they doing? you know, these are people, as we discussed the other day, Tom, and earlier this afternoon, that took an oath to uphold the Constitution. And that is not something that is supposed to be lightly, which apparently that is how this approach was, at least in my view.
Well, it's not the only time Bill's broken his oath of office. I can promise you that.
Yeah, and you know, we are getting close to being over, and I would like to, I'll do it this way. We have about 23 minutes left in the show, so we're going to continue on some things, but I want to invite you back to the show later on in this process. Obviously, I am not letting this investigation go, and I'm going to do everything I can, along with other people in the Coffee Party. We've already committed to the fact that we want to make sure that the light is shining, and it's for a lot of reasons. We're trying to show what's really going on, and we want people to be united in the discussion, not divided. I want to ask you one very important thing that we haven't covered yet, that's so important to me on some of the crisis that we're facing with the interaction with the community and the police, and that is the militarization from the equipment standpoint that is going on. Can you tell everybody what the population is of Lawrence County, for example, and Dublin, Georgia? Just we'll just start.
Well, it's somewhere, Dublin's right around 25,000.
Sure.
Lawrence County is, I think when I ran for sheriff, it was a little over 45. I think it's probably approaching 50 now. I'm not real sure.
In a county of 50,000 in Dublin, which is the county seat, is approximately half of that or so in population. And
well, I think it's important to recognize that it's also the third largest county in Georgia geographically. There's 842 square miles of county down here. And,
big.
It's a big county, and the majority of it's rural.
Sure, of course. So this is something that you're very familiar with from your work in two different counties as well as your history in law enforcement, is this militarization aspect of it. I'd like you to comment on that, please.
Okay, I will. I'd like to point out before I do that both of those counties are in the same judicial district, circuit. So, same judges, same attorneys. But as far as the militarization of police, this started a while back when you could have, and they started to have a surplus of military weapons and
1033 program.
Right, exactly. So you're applying for them, and they're pretty much just granting them wholesale. I want to make a point here. I don't really think that there's anything wrong with having that equipment. There's times when that equipment can come in hand. And if it ever comes down to a point of the sheriffs having to do one of their constitutional duties and defend their county against intrusion, then I think it's important for those weapons to be in place. But I think that only in the most extreme emergency situations should those weapons ever be deployed within the county on the citizens of that county, whether they're criminals or what. The State Patrol has SWAT teams that can respond. The GBI has SWAT teams that can respond. And I guarantee you, they are more highly trained than what that bunch out there is.
It's so warm when it comes to them. I love it.
the weaponization, I don't have a problem with. The militarization, yes, I have a big problem with it, because we have been turned into enemy combatants of the police.
Yeah, we have.
The citizenry of the United States has become have become the enemy.
Yeah.
Yes, and I'm going to tell you the rules of combat. The rules of engagement in combat are not the rules of engagement on the street.
That's important. Say that again. That is very, very important.
The rules
people to understand what's going on.
Right. The rules of engagement in combat are not the same as the rules of engagement in law enforcement. Now, yes, as a firearms instructor, I will tell you that I always taught, somebody presented a weapon at you or at someone else that you were to take immediate action. Okay? And in that regard, they're much the same. But at least until here recently, now the U.S. military is coming along, and they're changing this. There are some new rules of engagement. But the old ones were, hey, if he's got a gun, if he's around a gun, blow him up. That was the old military rules of engagement. And they're starting to move away from that. The problem is, it's starting to move into our country. Yeah.
Well, you know, the one aspect of this discussion that I have a problem with overall, you know, I don't like the fact that a lot of this equipment is going to the police department, period. And one of the things I counter with is, well, we have a National Guard. If we're coming to a situation where it is so extreme that these instruments of destruction and warfare are needed, those are the people who need to bring it out. I mean, Jesus, the city of Syracuse, you know, among a whole bunch of cities in this country, for example, just received a minesweeper military vehicle, for example. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous to the extent of what's going on.
I get you, and I agree with that. But when I'm talking about shoulder weapons and that type of thing. I'm not talking about tanks.
Oh, sure. Certainly. You know, but one of the things that I had a problem with the Ferguson case, when we initially went there to cover it and we had people on the ground doing video and stuff, and I actually was disappointed that I couldn't get there, one of the problems I had, it wasn't the case itself because the way that the police were handling the peaceful protesters, and when the speculation as to whether or not they were peaceful or not pretty much came to light when we had people who were actually there talking to the community and interacting, and what was going on there was really bad, and the use of tear gas and things like that. So that there's a broad subject with the militarization of the police, and I'm glad to hear you talk about how, like you say, the rules of engagement seem to be changing, and that's my problem with this personally, and I think a lot of people are, and what they're not understanding is how did we get from point A to point B, especially in communities. If you think about this, if you take away the big city aspect out of the equation just for a moment, even though you shouldn't have to, in a community of this size where you know that these people all know each other, it's just too small to not have that. You see the same people every day. You interact with the same people every day. Like you say, you were walking around football security. I happened to announce the football games for my son's high school. And I know all the police that work in security, of course, and they know me because we're there all the time. You know, so if they ever interacted with me, there should never be a problem that would escalate to something like that, as you mentioned. So it's crazy that the rules of engagement are being done like this, and we've tossed the Constitution aside when it comes to remembering that everybody's supposed to get a chance to state their case in court. That's where my problem is.
I couldn't agree with you more. I was born in 1951, so I grew
Certainly.
Up watching. I grew up watching Andy and Barney.
Mm-hmm.
and Barney, you know, Andy had to keep him in control. All right, but Andy was sure. You know, Andy taught us a lot of valuable lessons, a lot of valuable life lessons. And you didn't see Andy getting all heated up with people of his town. And there's no reason that we should get, there's no reason that the sheriff's office in Lawrence County or the police office anywhere USA should get heated up with its citizenry. We are there to serve them.
Right.
If you want to concentrate on something, concentrate on solving burglaries. You know, you got people out there stealing folks' stuff.
Right.
And put a little bit of effort into trying to solve as many of those that you could and quit concentrating on drugs so much. Then
I was going to say that next, the drug war.
Interact with the people of your county a little bit more. Instead of driving down a country road at 180 miles an hour, they won't do 180, at 85 miles an hour for no reason at all other than the fact that you're wearing a badge and toting a gun and who's going to stop you. Make a few stops. Walk up, knock on the door, introduce yourself, say, hey, are these the vehicles that are normally here? This is my patrol area, and I just want to get to know everybody out here and make sure that I'm able to keep you, making sure that I'm able to keep you safe. Now, those people are going to appreciate that, and they're going to pick up the phone, they're going to call you when things start happening. And that's the way it needs to be done. It doesn't need to be about stopping everybody for speeding and writing as many speeding tickets as you can so that it can go through the court system and the county can get rich on fines. And it doesn't need to be about all that. It needs to be about people taking care of people, doesn't matter what color they are, what religion they are, what. It doesn't matter about any of that. Taking care of your fellow man transcends any other aspect of human life. And when we kind of get back to that philosophy, especially in the police departments and the sheriff's offices, then we're going to have a better we're going to have a better society.
I couldn't agree with you more. I appreciate that. We're going to be winding up the show here, and what I'd like to do before I get to my closing is I'd like to give an opportunity for Catherine to make any comments she would like to make for the next couple of minutes, and I'll come back to you, Tom, for a closing statement.
Sure.
Catherine, I see that you're still there. Was there anything you'd like to say and add to this in closing, please?
Well, I wanted to let people know about the petition to suspend Deputy Chris Brewer for his actions in getting the search warrant. He is back on the job. He has not been suspended. He is, authorized to write more of these search warrants. So there's a petition at SpartacusLegal.org, and you can click on David Hooks, and then there's the petition to suspend Chris Brewer. So we're asking people to sign that, whether they live in Lawrence County or elsewhere. We're just trying to show that the people of all of Georgia and the United States are really ready for some accountability for these officers' actions. Because we have to remember, a man is dead, an innocent man. His constitutional rights have been violated in the most appalling way. And it's time to stand up and do something about it. You know, we can be respectful, we can be calm about it, but we have to insist on action because this is absolutely not something that anyone should ever accept. So we ask you to go to SpartacusLegal.org and sign the petition on the David Hooks page to suspend Chris Brewer.
Fantastic. And for those in the chat room, I just put the link in there, and please take a look at it and please join in. And we certainly want to demand accountability in Lawrence County. And Tom, thank you, Catherine, very much. And Tom, give me a closing statement to your thoughts on the David Hooks matter.
Well, it was entirely preventable. Entirely. And, the fact of the matter is that their incompetence and their rush to judgment, a cowboy attitude, cost an apparently innocent man his life. Oh, I'm not even going to say apparently. It cost an innocent man his life. And how do we know he's innocent? because they did not find what they went there looking for. And I will not let this stand, nor should anybody else let this stand. This is a time to speak up, folks. You know, this type of action needs to stop in the United States.
I appreciate it, Tom. Thank you so much for being on tonight's show and giving us a behind-the-badge look at policing policy practice, and particularly the incident that happened here in Lawrence County. I look forward to working with you and to talking to you some more on the show about this. And then, of course, anybody who wants to send any comments, please go to SpartacusLegal.org and on Facebook, Spartacus Legal. And certainly, Catherine will take a look at your comments and pass them on, and they'll share them with Tom as well. And, of course, you can get a hold of me through the coffee party. And if you have any comments with them as well. Tom, thank you again for being on the show. I appreciate it, and I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Bobby, I appreciate you having me, and you can call on me anytime. I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Great. Thank you, sir. So that's it for tonight's show. I take liberty. I got a couple of closing things I want to do that I didn't want to interrupt our momentum in the show to talk about Coffee Party Radio and take care of some other business. As you know, Coffee Party Radio, we have a number of shows that are on. We have on Thursday at 12 o'clock specific, 3 o'clock Eastern time, we have lunch with Loudon, with Janine Loudon, Debbie Lynn Molyneux, usually her co-host, well-researched information, great subject matter about what our society needs to hear and talk about the important issues, particularly involving the money and how it's corrupting our political system. And then on Saturday, we have Egberto Willis with Politics Done Right on Saturday afternoon, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. And again, Egberto is totally about what's best for our society and bringing forth the important issues for everybody to take a look at so they can make their own judgment. And as you know, here at the Coffee Party, we are about civility and about facts and about being transpartisan, coalition-building organization. Myself, I take liberty with my coffee and my show, and as you all know, I am the person that believes that if we move our government closer to constitutional behavior, and we hold our elected officials and our civil servants to constitutional behavior, that a lot of the ill wills in our society will be solved. Certainly, it would be when it comes to these recent incidents between the community and the police. Without question, the results of these would have been much better. I ask you to take a look at that. And also, when you think something has happened and it's somehow justified, there's been a lot of discussion about that, particularly with the Brown case, the Garner case, this case, about the argument between the anti-police, pro-police discussions that our mainstream media has gotten us running around with our heads cut off at. If you think about what would have happened if you were involved and the protections of the Constitution that you would have preferred, in this, I mean, just change your place with David Hooks. Change your place with Eric Garner. Wouldn't you? Don't you believe that if this happened to you, that your position would be somewhat a little different when it comes to whether or not the Constitution protects you or not? Same thing with the discussion with the recent release of the torture report and the discussion saying, well, they don't deserve the constitutional protections. Every single person on this earth is protected by our Constitution when they are accused of violating the laws of the United States. That's how it works. I don't care who you are, where you are, what you are. If you are accused of violating the laws of this country, then the law of this country dictates how you are treated by our government and civil service people, and that is with due process of law, period. There is no gray area there. I'm sorry, people, if you believe that alleged terrorists and anybody else deserves that kind of process, you are, in fact, wrong. You need to take a look at what it actually says in the Constitution, word for word. There's no gray area. No person shall be deprived. There is no more important words than that. No person shall be deprived. The sanctity of all human life is important, not just some above the other. Please. If we are to be the shining light of the world, it is more because we are the justice country than any other reason, in my view. As always, I want to thank everybody for chiming in. I appreciate Catherine Bernard and Tom McCain participating in tonight's show. And I want to let everybody know, next week, we're going to have Eleanor Goldfield on, the lead singer of Rooftop Revolutionaries and the director of Artists for Apathy, Against Apathy, sorry. And what Eleanor is going to be doing next week is she's traveling from California to Charlotte, North Carolina to feed the homeless, because in Charlotte, North Carolina, it is against the law to feed the homeless. So this is Civil Disobedience Peacefully, again. Once again, I want to thank everybody. Coffee party on, as Janine Loudon says all the time. Good night.